So welcome everybody to this another day of this wonderful opportunity to have a retreat. And I hope many of you are settling in now, got used to the place, caught up a little bit with your sleep, and just relaxed into the place. And today I don't plan these talks. Sometimes I just think, what's a nice topic to talk about? And I thought today would be a nice opportunity to give an overview of the Anapanasati, the breath meditation. Now when I say this, it's not what you do. You don't do breath meditation. This is just what happens when you start to let go. This is in the same way that those of you who flew from Singapore, if you look at that, the flight monitor, which tells you where the aircraft is, you know, you see that to get from Singapore to Perth, you have to go through over Indonesia, over Java, and then from Java, then you go over the coast of Australia. You have to go over the north before you go to the central, before you get to where Perth is. There's many landmarks on the journey. And that's what I'm talking about with Anapanasati, the mindfulness of the breath. These are just the landmarks which happen as you meditate. And it's useful to know those landmarks because you know what's happening, why it's happening. It gives you the overview of the journey. I know especially people from Singapore like to plan everything out first of all before they embark on the journey. So I thought it would be useful to have everything planned out so you know what's happening, you know what's going to happen, you know where this is all aiming for. So when these things do happen, you don't get surprised, you don't get afraid, you know exactly what's happening and what not to do, what not to do. So next. So the most important part about the breath meditation is actually, as I said yesterday, the preparation for it. So don't go on to the breath too quickly. I know over many years of teaching and even practicing myself, you know, sometimes you know that I work very hard and sometimes I'm tired. Sometimes you've been talking to all sorts of people about all sorts of problems, and you know, I have to work my mind. So when I sit down afterwards, you know, the mind is restless. So I don't go on to the breath straight away to try and subdue any restless mind. I just know how to relax. Relax my body, relax my mind. Just wait until the mind becomes like calm enough, you know, to be able to start watching the breath. So you don't do this straight away. This is the same as my simile of a carpenter. When a carpenter gets a piece of wood, before you start making a table or some shelves with that piece of wood, you have a look at that wood first of all to see what condition it's in. And if it's a piece of wood which has just been sawn from a log of the tree, you can't go sanding it down yet. You need to cut it to size, you need to plane it. And once it's planed to get the worst of the rough parts off, then you sand it with the roughest sandpaper first, and then the medium sandpaper, then the fine sandpaper, and last of all with a polishing cloth, so it becomes nice and smooth, you know, just like some of the wood which you see here or in the retreat center, or just the wood which you're sitting on, the bamboo. It's nice and smooth because it's been planed, it's been sanded, it's been polished. Now, if you get a rough piece of wood and you try and polish it with a cloth, you're just wasting a lot of time and a lot of cloths. And that's just like when you have a rough mind and you try and just to watch the breath. Just it won't work. And either, you know, you think that, oh, I can't meditate, or you get so frustrated, you try harder. And that's where the difficulties in meditation come from, because you haven't really prepared sort of the mind yet, just like the carpenter hasn't prepared the wood for polishing. So to get the rough edges off the mind, that's why we relax, we rest, we have a bit of fun. And that sort of makes the mind calm, peaceful and bright. And then, if you try and meditate, it's just so easy to do. I was just telling my monks just on a talk on Wednesday night that I suffer from hay fever. It's not bad, but you know sometimes it gets like I'm sneezing a lot. And last week, I think it was on Tuesday, it was very bad hay fever. So I don't usually take any medication, but that day I decided to take some medication for hay fever. And that just cleared up the sinuses and cleared up my head. And it felt so good. I was so happy that, you know, I could breathe properly and no sneezing. I got this wonderful meditation. And I mentioned that to the monks, and all the monks wanted to go to the medicine cabinet to get some. It was. It just gave me a little boost of happiness, a little boost of joy. Isn't it nice? I can breathe. Wonderful. And that joy, that happiness, that sense of you feel really content, you feel nice, you feel comfortable. Now that's an important preparation for meditation. Upal, you know that monk you gave breakfast to at Singapore last week? And he was he had to go to Singapore just for one night to renew his visa. It's one of those visas where he had to leave the country, and when he came back again, it's automatically renewed for another year. So it's just what you have to do. So he went to Singapore, stayed in the night at the BF. I think Upal gave him breakfast in the morning, and of course, when he came back here, he got his visa. And he told me he was just so elated that it all worked out perfectly. There was no problems at all. He was well looked after. Because he was elated, he had a really good meditation that night. And when he told me, he said, yes, this is what happens. You prepared the mind. You've given it some joy, some relation. Wonderful thing. And that means that you get nice meditation. It's easy to watch the breath. Now that's why bringing a little bit of joy into your mind is preparing the piece of wood for polishing, preparing your mind. And that's one of the reasons I tell jokes. To prepare your mind for enlightenment. To make you happy. You know, because when you're happy, when you get a bit of joy, you know, it means that, you know, the mind is brighter and it's easier to meditate. So I mentioned jokes, I better tell one now. Okay, I think I told this on Friday night about, you know that sort of, you know, especially here in Australia and also in Singapore, it's very important to have interreligious harmony. And so because it's in, I think I told that joke about the, no, that was on Friday night, about there was this Buddhist monk, this Christian priest, and this Jewish rabbi. And they decided for interfaith harmony they should actually meet every week, you know, maybe for lunch or breakfast or a cup of tea or coffee. So they met regularly. And as they met regularly, you know, it became much more than just discussing the different religions. They actually became really good friends. And because they became good friends, they used to go meet each other regularly, and they decided, you know, to just do something to increase their harmony. They started like playing cards, and one thing led to another, they started gambling. And that was illegal. So somebody found out and they told the police, they got arrested, they had to have a trial in the court. So there they were, these three leaders of religion on trial. And the first to give evidence was the Christian priest. And the judge looked him in the eye and said, look, you know, you are all three leaders of religion, I'm not going to mess around, I'm just going to ask you straight, were you gambling? And before the judge could actually see him, he looked up to heaven and said, please forgive me, God. And he said, no, I wasn't. Okay, the next one was a Jewish rabbi. And the Jewish rabbi sort of was asked the same question, were you gambling? And the rabbi put his hands behind his back and crossed his fingers and said, no, I wasn't. And the third man in there was a Buddhist monk. And the judge said, you Buddhist monks, I know about you. You keep, you know, more than the five precepts. It's just against your rules to lie. You have to be honest. So I'm going to ask you, were you gambling? And the Buddhist monk said, with whom? So
So now you're happy.
You find it easier to meditate. You feel joy, you feel light. And all those heavy problems and worries and frustration just disappear when you feel happy. Now, how do you feel right now? Light, you feel good. Now this is why we do preparation before we even go on to Anapanasati. So that's why this retreat center is beautiful, comfortable, and you've got these great grounds to walk in. I just want to walk all the way around on the other side of the lake. It's beautiful over there. It's delightful. So delight the mind in the beauty of the nature here. And then when you go and meditate, it's easy. As I said yesterday, your mind is like your friend. If you look after your friend and have a good time together, and of course your mind wants to cooperate. So this is actually, I was actually reading about, there's all sorts, I'm going off on tangents now. You know that when there was all this problem with the US government interrogating these potential terrorist detainees, and they were saying they're doing this waterboarding and other forms of torture. And I remember some person said, look, that's stupid. Not only is it against human rights, but it just doesn't work. And he said, the modern forms of interrogation, remember this chief interrogator of the CIA, he wrote this article, he just know we take the people out for lunch. We know have a nice walk in the forest. We just talk about all sorts of things. We become friends with them. He said, once we become friends, they tell us everything. And actually, this was not a joke. This was one of the senior interrogators who spent his whole life sort of trying to get information out of these very dangerous people. And that's the state-of-the-art way of doing it. Being friends with someone, and then they cooperate. Now, I don't know how many of you have been treating your mind like a prisoner in Guantanamo Bay. Forcing it, torturing it, telling it all off many, many times. But of course, that doesn't work. And no, it doesn't work. But if you're kind to the mind, befriend it, take it for a walk, give it a cup of tea or coffee, tell it a joke, then your mind cooperates. And that's what we call that first part of meditation, a preparation. And that's why, you've heard me teach retreats many times. I put so much effort into that preparation that sometimes people think, well, we're not doing anything, we're not really meditating, we're just hanging out, taking it easy. This is just like a resort, not a meditation center. I remember actually when you people from the BF, when you first came here, you had a look around and said the huts are very nice and it's very beautiful food and kitchen. You said the one thing missing from this place is a golf course. If you had a golf course here, it would be a resort. But no, this is a meditation center. And we spend the first few days just relaxing, getting some happiness up. When that happiness comes up, you find it's easy to meditate because your mind will cooperate with you. Just like the interrogator from the CIA would take the friends out, befriend the person he's trying to find information from. Take many days sometimes. And after you get friends with them, oh, they'll just share anything with you. Now, once you've befriended the mind and it feels good together, then you start just letting go of the past and the future. Which is such an important part of meditation. I have to keep mentioning that because still many of you are wondering about your problems back home. That's all in the past, it's gone. Yesterday the question about your boss. The boss is in the past. Now let him go. About the future, about what's going to happen when you go back. Without letting go of the future and the past, there's no real way that you can focus on the breath. So again, I've made a lot of emphasis to people just being here in the present moment. What that really means is that when you are going for a walk, don't have any destination where you're trying to get to. Don't have any idea of where you've come from. Just where you are right now. So, because when you have a destination, your mind is way over there in the ending point. So you can't really enjoy where you are right now. When you're in the present moment, you're here. We call this in the Buddhist's explanation of Anapanasati, of mindfulness on the breath, he said this is the preliminary exercise in establishing mindfulness. What is mindfulness? It's the awareness focused in this moment. If your awareness is, you know, off into the future or the past, it's not real mindfulness. Because, you know, what you think might happen in the future never does happen. And I mentioned that again many times, that all my worries, all the things I think might go wrong, they never go wrong. Something else goes wrong instead. But not the thing I expected. So all the worries which I've had in my life are just a total waste of time. And I look back upon all the things I've worried about and thought I could have used my time much more wisely. And if you keep reflecting like that about worries and concerns about the future, after a while you get wise enough not to worry at all. Look at me when I was a student. I used to worry about my exams, worry about passing my O-levels, worrying about passing my A-levels, worrying about getting a good degree. What a waste of time. I was going to become a monk. So you don't worry anymore. Worrying about girlfriends. Again, I'd be a monk. I don't need a girlfriend. I shouldn't have worried at all. I just enjoyed myself. So most of the worries which you have are hopeless, useless, which is why we just let them all go. And you can be totally free, you've got nothing to worry about. You know you're going to have dinner or lunch at 11 o'clock. It's going to be there for you. You don't know what you're going to have, but it's going to be nice. You don't have to think, you don't have to plan. And what that does, it means the mindfulness is free to be in this moment. Instead of it, you know, most of it being in the past or the future, and only a little bit left for this moment, for being alive, for being aware, all of it is now at your disposal to be aware. So you're in this moment. That's a wonderful thing. It's like you're alive. It's like you're here. And once you're alive, once you're here, once you're mindful, then the next thing we do is to let go of this inner speech. Because we do think a lot, it's just bad habits, that's all. Again, you don't need to think. What are you thinking about? Sometimes you look back at the last 5 minutes, what you thought about. Has that been useful at all? It's been a total waste of time. But sometimes people tell me they can't stop thinking. And I tell them, I argue with them. I say, yes, you can. They say, no, we can't. And I say, yes, you just did. Because we have this beautiful little trick in meditation. And it's a wonderful trick. I've done this in Singapore many times, done this here. It's actually to listen to the space between the words. When I pause between the words, your mind is perfectly silent. Doesn't that feel so? You see, you can be still. You can be aware without any thoughts going on in your mind. Isn't that wonderful? It's nice being able to do that exercise and demonstration, because I'm not talking about it, you're experiencing it. So I'm transmitting to you what it's like to be aware in this moment with silence. And in this retreat, you cultivate that. You cultivate the experience of being able to walk out in the gardens and not think, but just have that same state of mind that you had a few minutes ago, totally aware, but not thinking, not naming, not doing anything. There's this old story, and I cannot improve upon it, but it does tell you what we're doing. There was a story of Lao Tzu and his disciple. He would go on a walk with one disciple every evening, and there was a golden rule that the disciple was not allowed to speak during the walk with the master. They had to be totally quiet. However, it happened one evening on their walk, there was this beautiful sunset, and the student just forgot the rule and said to the master, "Wow, what a beautiful sunset." He'd broken the rule. He'd spoken. And Lao Tzu, he didn't say, "You've broken the rule," otherwise Lao Tzu would have broken the rule as well. He just turned around and went back to the monastery. And when he got back to the monastery, then he said to that student, "You can't go on a walk with me ever again. You broke the rule." And of course the disciple was disappointed. His friends tried to intercede. So come on, give him another chance, give him a break. Anyway, what's wrong with just saying what a beautiful sunset? When I read that story, Lao Tzu's answers, you know, made a light bulb go on in my head. You realize the difference between observing in silence and observing with thought. Lao Tzu said, "When my student said, 'What a beautiful sunset,' he was not watching the sunset anymore. He was just watching the words." When you say, "What a beautiful tree," you're not looking at the tree anymore. You're looking at the words. And there's a huge difference there between thinking, "What a beautiful sunset," and knowing the sunset. So when you're walking through the forest, don't walk through the thoughts of the forest. Walk through the forest. So you're not thinking that this is a Mary tree, this is a Wandu, this is this type of tree or that type of tree. Keep the mind quiet. And then you'll see the trees. You'll be with the trees. Because in the silence, there's a much greater awareness. So during this retreat, we cultivate that silence. To be aware without thinking. We cultivate that present moment just to be here. Forget about the next moment. Forget about the last moment. Just be in life as it happens. And once you've developed that degree of mindfulness, usually the breath just comes to you anyway. That's what I do. I sit here and just let go of all the past, let go of all the future. Be quiet, be silent, relax. And the breath comes to me. Just this beautiful breath. Just breathing in, breathing out. First of all, in breath meditation, it does not matter where you watch your breath. It does not have to be at the tip of your nose. It does not have to be on your belly. I already mentioned that, you know, I suffer from hay fever. And I remember when I first learned meditation, I was told to watch the tip of the nose. And it was a problem for me. Because nothing was happening there. My nose was blocked. So I thought, my goodness, every time I got a cold or got hay fever, I won't be able to meditate. Maybe I didn't have enough good karma to be enlightened. Even these days, I often complain about my nose, and I'm just waiting for medicine to advance enough that I can get a nose transplant. You can get lung transplants, you can get liver transplant, heart transplants, but I want a nose transplant. Then I won't have to blow anymore. They'll have to stitch it on pretty tightly though, because if I blow when the stitches are on, it might come off. And being in Australia, I thought actually, I always wanted an Aboriginal nose. I thought that would be an expression of interracial harmony. I'd have a white face with a black nose. So it'd be recognisable at the airport. You're imagining it now. Maybe someone on Photoshop could actually do a mock-up just to see what it would look like. Anyway, So I thought that I would never be able to meditate. But then, when I was meditating in London, then someone told me about the Mahasi technique. You don't watch the tip of the nose, you watch your tummy go up and down. And I thought, ah, at last, now I can meditate without having to worry about hay fever. But then, when I went on my first retreat, there was a problem. I put my attention on my tummy. And it was the afternoon, there it goes again, you can see the tummy rumbling. When my attention was down there, it wasn't watching the rise and fall of my abdomen. It was watching the emptiness of my stomach. I was hungry. So you try that, watching a rise and fall of your abdomen this evening, maybe 7 or 8 o'clock. You think, I'm hungry, I was doing. So that never worked either for me. And then you figured out another light bulb came on in your head. The Buddha never said to watch the nose. He never said to watch the tummy. He said to watch the breath. And I could do that very easily. Even if my nose was stuffed up, even if I was hungry, I was always breathing. So these days when I teach meditation to absolute beginners, I tell them to close their eyes and breathe in and out 3 times and then open their eyes. I haven't told them anything else about meditation, just that. Close your eyes, breathe in and out 3 times, and then open your eyes. And once they've completed that easy task, then I ask them, how did you know you'd breathe in and out 3 times? What told you? And they knew they were breathing in. They knew they were breathing out. They knew the second in-breath was happening, the second out-breath, the third in-breath. They completed the third out-breath. They knew that naturally. And they actually weren't watching it anywhere in the body. They just felt it. They knew they were breathing in. They knew they were breathing out. And that's the way I do my breath meditation. I teach others. The natural way, you know you breathed in, you know you breathed out. That much. It doesn't have to be anywhere on the body. And in fact, for those of you taking this meditation deeper, the less you identify with the breath being any part of your body, the easier it will be. Because we let go of the body, it disappears after a while. And the sooner you can stop focusing on the body, the better. Oh, I have to also point out, there's another problem with focusing on the tip of the nose. And I like doing this exercise, but I have to take off my glasses. Usually, when you meditate, you've got your eyes closed. Now I'm going to meditate with my eyes open now. And I'm going to focus on the tip of my nose. Just watching the breath go in and out, and in and out, and in and out. Now you know that's what you do as well. If you focus on the tip of your nose, it becomes automatic. It's just psychology. Your eyes go down there as well. Now you try doing that for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, you get headache. And many people used to come to me and said, oh, they got samadhi headache, they called it. They'd be meditating, they've got this tension across their forehead. And that's what causes it. It's very simple. Because when you put your mind here, it's just naturally your eyes go there as well. It becomes just unconscious, but you just do that. And so your eyes get strained, and after a while it causes tension and a headache. So it's much better just to watch the breath quite naturally, just whatever it's doing. And when you watch it quite naturally, because you're not forcing it to be anywhere, it's always there for you, you can always notice it. You make a friend with it. So when you make friends with it, as I said, breath likes you, you like the breath. It's a wonderful psychology to have friends with your meditation object. For many people, when they do breath meditation, they treat their breath like a slave. Sometimes I read all these stories, you know, about the way that some people in Singapore treat their maids. You know, the horror stories, beating them or torturing them or something. And sometimes, you know, that's how people treat their breath. Breath!
You stay here. Stop wandering off. Or otherwise I'll cane you, I'll beat you, I'll torture you, I won't play with you anymore.
And of course, if you treat a maid like that, you get into big trouble. They just don't want to work for you. If you treat your breath like that, it won't stay with you. So you treat your breath when you're doing breath meditation, where you're not the master or the mistress, and the slave is there to do your bidding. It's a friend, it's an equal. So breath, come on, let's hang out together. Are you okay? And the breath might say, well, I'll be back in a few minutes, I've just got to think about my business back in Singapore. What do? You say, okay, just you go off and I'll be waiting for you when you come back. Be kind. And then it's amazing what happens then. Let the breath actually, oh thank you, I've done my stuff, I'm going to come back with you now and stay with you for a while. If you're kind, the breath wants to hang out with you. And that's actually how we get this full attention on the breath. First of all, we just know the breath is going in, going out. And the Anapanasati Sutta, the Buddha said, we know it's long, we know it's short. You know, my breath is now, sometimes it's not long, sometimes it's not short, sometimes it's in the middle. But the Buddha never mentioned that. I thought, my goodness, the Buddha made a mistake. But the Buddha never made a mistake. It's just that long or short or in between, very long, ultra long, extreme short, doesn't matter, as long as you know that what the breath is up to. That's all, just an example. But then after a while, when you're actually with a friend, if you've ever been with a friend and you've been talking and you've been totally fascinated with what they're saying, but everything else disappears. You know, you lose track of time. Maybe even like in a busy street, but it's such an interesting conversation, you don't hear the traffic. You just have a wonderful time together. That's what happens with the breath. You know, you're just with the breath going in and out and spending all this time together. You lose track of time and you forget all the other people in this room. You're just with the breath and there's nothing else in your mind. One of the reasons that is happening is because you're enjoying each other's company. And the reason why you're enjoying the company of your breath, because your mind is now still enough and subtle enough to enjoy the beauty of simplicity. It's one of the important aspects of meditation. As this retreat progresses, everything becomes more beautiful. The food becomes more tasty. The beds become softer as you become more sensitive. It's a strange experience, but it's true. The very first meditation retreat I ever went to was in Cambridge, so I was still a student. And we hired three boarding houses in Cambridge during the vacation. Now that was in 1970 or 71, I forget which, now over 40 years ago. Now I think you always also know that the English were notorious worldwide for the fact they couldn't cook. Their food was tasteless. I remember the food we used to eat, it was meat and two veg, and the vegetables were boiled to hell. Until all the taste was totally removed. Until it doesn't matter what vegetable it was, they all tasted the same. Now that was just ordinary cooking in England. Now this was boarding houses for poor students. So this was the bottom of the pile of cooks. Now chefs who couldn't get a job anywhere else would get a job you know, cooking for students who couldn't afford anything else, who certainly couldn't afford to complain. So when I heard that the group of meditators were going to have a retreat in boarding houses with boarding house food for 9 days, I thought I'd better take some sandwiches, anything, because I knew it was going to be terrible food. But I didn't really have much choice, couldn't take sandwiches. But I was surprised. That food was actually tasty. It was delicious. And it was such a surprise, I always remember it, but I never understood why. At the time I thought I was just lucky, good karma. Of all the boarding house cooks in the whole of the country, I got a good one. it wasn't. What was happening? Because I was meditating. My mind was becoming peaceful. Instead of all of that attention going to thinking and worrying, or past and future, all my attention was in the present moment. So I was actually sensitive. So that tiny fraction of taste which was left after all that boiling, I could actually pick up. There wasn't much to pick up, but I could pick it up. And that's why it was tasty. And you will find on this retreat, as the day goes by, you will get more peaceful. The food will become more and more and more delicious. If you have a very, very good retreat, when you go home, your wife will look so beautiful. Say, my goodness, darling, have you had makeover? And of course, it's nothing to do with that. Everything to do with, you know, that you'll become more sensitive, more beautiful. Just like, you know, after all that boiling, you can find some taste. After all those years in your wife, you can actually see something really beautiful. You know, the tiny bit which is left. I better change the subject quick. I'm going to get into trouble. So that's actually what happens. Because you start to get sensitive, even when you watch the breath becomes actually quite delightful. Just because you're peaceful and quiet. And the trees become more beautiful. Everything becomes so lovely when you're still and peaceful. Which is why you can watch the breath for hours. It becomes what I call the delightful breath. Just breathing in. It's not just a boring breath. Oh, this is so nice. Breathing out. Oh, yeah. Give me more. Oh, bring it on. Now, that's not an exaggeration. That's actually what it's like when you become still. The breath becomes absolutely delightful. And because it becomes delightful, you get this feedback loop. Because it's delightful, you don't have to put any effort to keep watching it. It's just natural. Because it's delightful, you want to watch it more. Because you want to watch it more and the mind doesn't wander, the mind becomes more still. You see more beauty with that breath. And you get this quality in meditation we call the piti sukha. This joy, this happiness come up in the meditation. And of all the things which I want to give you, I just want to have you experience that piti sukha of meditation. Just the joy of it. Because that's what hooked me into meditation. And that gave me just so much happiness, insight, peace and freedom. Just the joy of stillness. It's absolutely fantastic. So as you become still, that's what happens. You're sitting here and the breath's going in, the breath's going out. It's going in, going out. You don't feel any aches or pains in the body. You're just having a great time. The mind is becoming more and more still, more and more peaceful, and more joyful. I do call that like a pivot point in meditation. I think the term is really like a tipping point. Because once the meditation gets very joyful and happy, you don't need to discipline yourself. You don't do something to get up early in the morning. You don't say, oh, I better go and meditate. That's what other people are doing. Or my partner's meditating. I better get in here quick. No, you just want to. I think I said, it's just like, and I think I said this to the monks, that when you have like a dog, and it's time for the dog to go on a walk, and the dog knows you're going to take it for a walk, the dog starts wagging its tail and running around in circles. The dog gets ecstatic, it's going for a walk. That's like my mind when I say, do you want to meditate? My mind runs around in circles, it wags its tail. Oh, he's taking me for meditation. Great. Because you enjoy it that much. So this is when you get the delightful breath coming up. Now remember, I haven't said anything about trying or pushing. Totally the opposite. This is what happens when you become still, when you let go. When you stay in the present moment, you're quiet. Still. And you either just Ask yourself, am I breathing in or am I breathing out? You start focusing on the breath, just quite naturally. And because you're still and peaceful, you got a bit of joy to begin with, then the breath gets very beautiful. And once it starts to happen and you're watching this beautiful breath, then you're off. It gets more and more beautiful. But when these things do happen, please be wary of two dangers. And those two dangers are excitement and fear. You know what happens once it starts working? Yeah, it started the last I could meditate. Stupid, you've blown it again. Then it was happening quite nicely and you got involved. You know, there's once when I went on pilgrimage to India when I was, I think, 20. No, 21. Because I was a Buddhist and I was still a lay person. And I thought, it's a good thing to do, to go and see the holy sites of India. So that was in 1972 or something. So it's very hard actually to find them to begin with. I only managed to get to two of them. But while I was up there, I was up in Kathmandu, and I heard that, you know, you could just, pay a few rupees, and you can get into one of the post vans, which would take the mail, early in the morning from Kathmandu, right to the border of Tibet, and then they'd sort of bring you back again the same day. You know, not supposed to do that, supposed to be in the mail van, but they take a few passengers to get a bit of money on the side. So, you know, I went on one of those trips. And when I went to India, one of the things I wanted to see, as well as the holy sites, were the Himalaya mountains. Because people said how magnificent they are. One of the great wonders of the world is beautiful range of incredibly tall mountains. And of course, I was stupid. I went in the rainy season. So you couldn't see any mountains. There was clouds everywhere. And so I was really disappointed that, you know, having gone all that way, I couldn't see these great mountains. So I just gave up. But anyway, on this trip, the postman stopped for tea somewhere. We were going to have half an hour. And I was with a couple of other guys. And, you know, there's only a little hill. Let's climb to the top, see what's on the top. Just a bit of exercise. And we got to the top of that hill. The clouds parted. And you could see the Himalaya mountains. It's actually a magnificent sight. Especially when you hadn't seen them at all before. And there it was clear, the snow was glistening on the peaks. It's an absolutely wonderful sight. You know what I did? I ran down the hill to get my camera. These things just happen. I'm not exaggerating this. This is really what happened. I ran down the hill to get my camera. Ran up again. And just about a second, because the other two guys were up there watching all the time, enjoying it. They said, "Where did you go?" Because about 1 or 2 seconds before I reached the top, the clouds closed up again. And I never saw it again for that whole trip. But it's wonderful teaching for me. Look, beauty, delight, joy, you can't photograph. It showed me that when you have beauty, you have to leave it alone and not interfere with it. And just enjoy it. You can't capture it. You can't grasp it. You can't bottle it. You can't put it in a photograph. Because if you try, you lose everything. And that was my lesson from that experience. I should have sat up there and just allowed it to be photographed in my memory. Just enjoy it, rather than try and put it on a machine. And that's the same when I get joy in meditation. I don't try and photograph it, to keep it, to grasp it. Because if I do, it disappears again. I just have to let it be there. And enjoy it, just be with it. So when the happiness does come, don't try and control it or capture it. Just like the Himalaya mountain. Just got to be there and the clouds will close. But if you try and keep it and photograph it, you lose everything. So that when you are enjoying things, just let it be. Don't try and grasp and capture. But the next thing is sometimes that happiness gets a bit scary. Because it gets quite intense at times. Just having a wonderful time, and you think, my goodness, what's going on? Is this supposed to happen? Am I supposed to be so happy? This is supposed to be, the Buddha talked about suffering. I'm not suffering, I'm happy. Yes, but the Buddha also talked about the end of suffering. Now you actually tasting the end of suffering. You're actually tasting freedom. This is what's supposed to happen. This is why I mention this. So when you start to get happy in your meditation, don't think that something must be going wrong. It's supposed to happen that way. Let it come. Don't be afraid. You can't control it, because it all comes from letting go. You're not supposed to control it. The more you try and control and get involved, the more it's going to vanish. You're spoiling it. So when the happiness does come, just let it be. Sometimes people say when they get this beautiful, delightful breath, what are they supposed to observe? Are they supposed to watch the breath or start to watch the delight? What are you supposed to do? You should all know the answer by now. Just keep it natural. If the mind wants to watch the breath, fine. You can watch the breath. If you want to watch the delight, fine, watch the delight. You don't control, you don't give orders. We call this actually just being a real passenger, but not a back seat driver. There's many people who are back seat drivers. And a classic case is a lady who, she does come on many of my retreats. Actually, she's coming on the next retreat just a week after this one. So I can't tell the story when she's here. But you know, she picked me up from Heathrow Airport once when I was visiting England. But with her son. So her son was driving in the front. And I was sitting in the passenger seat. And she was in the back seat. And my goodness, from Heathrow Airport to sort of Selsdon in Kent, she never stopped for 2 minutes giving instructions to her son. No, don't drive so fast. Pull over to the left. Let that person in. This is a much better way. Don't go speeding. Don't do this. And she was, I never seen a backseat. She's a really nice lady and a very sort of faithful, good person. But she was just a classic backseat driver. Maybe it's because of her son. You know, mothers and sons, you know. Even though he's about 30, still she told him what to do. Anyhow. Don't be like that in your meditation. Don't be a backseat driver and tell your mind, come on, watch the breath. No, no, what's the bliss? Ajahn Brahm said to do this. Ajahn Brahm said, no, shut up. And just let the meditation evolve. So be careful of backseat driving in that particular part of meditation. Your job is just to be a passenger. Your mind is very clever and smart. It knows what to do. You just got to let it do it. Let it have fun and joy and peace and bliss. And then that's part of the breath meditation. People sometimes say, well, aren't you supposed to watch the breath all that time? I say, no, the breath has done its job, it's done its work. In the same way, this is actually adapted from the Samanyapala Sutta. In the same way, actually, to get to this retreat center, you know, you came in aircraft, Singapore Airlines or Tiger Air or Thai Airways. But you can't land the aircraft at Jhana Grove Retreat Center. You have to land it at the airport. That's as far as the aircraft can take you. And then from there, you get people like Mark pick you up and bring you here. But he can't drive the car into your cottage. The car goes as far as the car park. That's as far as a car can go. And then you have to walk the rest of the way. That's the same with breath. Breath can get you so far. And once it's got you to as far as breath can go, then bliss, the happiness, takes you further. Which is why I make the very profound point that you feel your way into the deep meditations. You don't think your way into deep meditation. You feel your way through. This is all about the skill in just being with beautiful emotions like joy and happiness. The skill in just cultivating them, leaving them alone, allowing them to grow without hindering them. It's the same as the skill of a gardener. You know, you have a plant, you nurture and cultivate it, but what you're really doing is protecting it from being interfered with. Plants grow naturally. So your bliss, your happiness, it will grow naturally. Your job is just to protect it. Protect it from yourself, from interfering with it. And if you can just protect it that way, the bliss just grows. And that's part of the meditation. The bliss is taking you deeper into stillness. And the reason is because once you're happy, who wants to go anywhere? When you're really having a good time, the mind doesn't want to move at all. It gets more and more still. And it gets into incredible states of peace. It's a wonderful thing as a meditator to actually to explore to the very depths the meaning of peace. And you find that most people in this world haven't got a clue what peace truly means. All they've ever known is noise and movement, agitation and irritation. And using bliss as your meditation object, the mind gets more and more still, more and more powerful, more deep, more profound. And you get incredible insights into what peace truly means. And what happiness really is. I've often told you that one of the great reasons I'm a monk is for the sake of happiness. I'm not doing this because I'm an ascetic. I'm doing this because I love happiness. And I've got, you know, choice. If I wanted to, I can leave and go and do something else. We only stay as a monk because you know there's so much great happiness here. Happiness through stillness, through joy, through peace. And this is the way you too can have the insight into the real meaning of happiness. As an experience, not thinking it through, but experiencing it. And what real peace of mind truly is. Sitting here, your eyes closed, blissed out, so at peace, not wanting to go anywhere in the whole world. Wow, isn't this cool? So that's what happens in your meditation. The reason I'm saying that is to get you interested. It's called brainwashing. Marketing, if you like. And it's not a hard thing to do. You just got to follow the instructions, which I give many of. And sometimes people say, well, Ajahn Boy, you've been talking for a whole hour. I won't remember all these things you said at the beginning. Strange, but you do. All those little pieces of instruction, you know, things like backseat driving, when it really means something to you, when it's necessary, the thought will come up into your mind, I'm being a backseat driver, and you stop. This is actually how I know conditioning works. Very often in my meditation, you come across a difficulty, and you get some idea, and the difficulty will disappear. And after I say, where did that come from? And I remembered Ajahn Chah telling me that a long time ago. It's like put in my mind, like I compare it to like the, you know, the antiviruses in your computer. Now you've downloaded all those antiviruses, they're in there, but they only activate when they're needed. So I've given you lots of antiviruses, which stop all the defilements, you know, interfering with your meditation and crashing your meditation. No, it feels like that sometimes. Sometimes your meditation crashes and you've got to reboot. But with all these antiviruses, that they can stop all of that and get very deep and very peaceful. So that is actually meditation on the breath. Prepare yourself. Get some joy and happiness coming up. Just focus on the breath. Just gently, wherever it happens to be, not tip of the nose, not the stomach. Allow it to become a beautiful breath. And then let the beauty take over. See what happens, and have the time of your life. Not the time of your life, the time of your many lives. Here in Jhanagraha Retreat Centre. So, there we go. Any questions or comments? Yes, Mary.
Oh.
okay. Of course, I've known you for a long time, Mary. You are a happy person. And you see you walking or weeding with a smile on your face. But when you say you meditate, it's like a different ball game. What's going on? And it is because many people have been conditioned to feel that meditation is going to be difficult. Meditation is one of these things you have to endure. Meditation, no pain, no gain. You've got to force yourself. And it's that attitude which has been embedded in many people which you have to change. So the next time you meditate, sit down, rub your hands together, let's have some fun. I'm going to enjoy this. Okay, let's see what we can have. Good fun. And you close your eyes. Fun time. Just a couple of days ago I was doing that. I was meditating. I said, oh, I'm going to have some fun. Because then I've been talking to many people and just having many problems. So many things go on in monasteries and Buddhist societies. And you get a bit tired sometimes and just fed up with all these people, just all these problems and stuff. First day I came off retreat, you know, 15 days I was in my cave, just having a wonderful time. And so, you know, you come off the retreat, and then you have to take the phone calls in the evening. Ajahn Brahm, yes, you know, I'm having trouble with my husband. You know, I've left him a couple of times, but, you know, then I've come back again, but, you know, he doesn't really appreciate me, and I don't know what to do. I've just come off retreat. What's this got to do with me? So that's my life as a Buddhist monk. And it's from overseas. It wasn't even from Perth. It was, I think, from some foreign country somewhere, a long way away. And we call it Dial a Monk service. So, you know, you have a few calls like that, and you go back. And so then, no, I'm going to have some fun. So I just sat and then said, okay, fun time now. And straight away, because you let go of that negativity, and the mind was looking for fun, you get some nice meditation coming. So, Mary, you're a fun-loving girl outside. Be a fun-loving girl inside. Okay, I'm going to enjoy this. I'm going to have some fun. And when you have that attitude, it changes the whole of meditation. There's this one guy who took me to a retreat in Sydney once. He was driving me there. And we were talking on the way there, and he said that the last retreat he did there was one of these very strict Vipassana retreats. And he said that, you know, they had so much pain in that meditation hall that he called it the torture chamber. So every time he went into the meditation hall, here we go in the torture chamber again. So I thought, oh, come on. So I said, right, on my retreat, I want you every time you go into that hall to meditate, to call it the entertainment center. Not the torture chamber, the entertainment center. And it actually worked, because his whole attitude when he came in, he was not looking for pain or expecting pain, but expecting some happiness and some joy. And so it worked, he found the joy and happiness. Don't meditate too hard, nor too long. Forcing yourself never works. This beautiful softness, this sensitivity, until the mind just really wants to meditate. And just sitting down here, oh great, meditation time. And I've got 2 hours before lunch. Hooray, 2 hours to meditate, brilliant. Until it gets to that point, which always happens in my retreats. It's 11 o'clock, time for lunch. You haven't eaten for a long time. You say, I'm not going to eat. I'm going to enjoy my meditation instead. Now that actually shows you how much joy you're having. When it gets to having lunch or meditating, there's no choice, you have to meditate. Because you're having just too much fun. Then you know your meditation's going well. Yes.
You always meditate in a cave.
Yeah. Okay, I enjoy meditating in caves. I must admit, caves are my favourite place to meditate in. But I meditate anywhere. Just, you know, very often, in hospital beds, I remember in the middle of Perth once that we had this, I think it was a Burmese community, you know, were doing some sort of demonstration about the political situation in Burma. You know, it continues on there. It's a terrible situation there for human rights and politics and whatever. But they wanted to make it like a peaceful Buddhist demonstration. So they're inviting people just to meditate. This was, for those of you who know Perth, just opposite Hay Street Mall, one of the busiest shopping streets in the whole of Perth. And they invited me to come up to sit for a couple of hours. So there you are, sitting on the hard pavement, no cushions. And right opposite was, I noticed that before I closed my eyes, was a time zone, one of these video parlors, blaring out all this noise. And it was one of the most noisiest places you could ever meditate in. I had a wonderful meditation. I thought, oh, this is going to be a nice test. Now, do I need my cave, or can I sort of meditate in deep peace in the middle of the city, on the pavement, sort of opposite this shop, you know, with all these video games, blaring out this really crazy, stupid music. And it was easy. It's a nice meditation in there. Just go very deep. So you don't have to have a cave. In fact, the Buddha actually said when you get deep in meditation, he called that Hadaya Guha, which is the cave of the heart. That's actually what he described, the deep meditations. You go deep inside. So all the noise, even though you're in the city, all the noise is like meters of miles away. But it helps being in a cave. Darkness? Not really, because, you know, I've got my eyes closed. You know, in the middle of the day, you've got your eyes closed, and it's like you're dark. After a while, you can't see anything. The atmosphere is good, though. And I mention this, I mean, I've got to be honest with you, okay? That, you know, many of you have come to visit my cave. You know, it's one of the sort of the tourist attractions of Bodhidharma Monastery now. And some of you have been in there and taken photographs in the cave. But, you know, after you've been, you know, I notice there's a change there. I have to sort of meditate some more to get it back, the energy levels back again. It's true, I'm going to be honest. I don't mind you coming, I can get it back again pretty quick. But, you know, there's a change there. Because, you know, I sit in that cave and get some really nice meditations, you get huge energies in there. So that's what I do, just get, because you build up the energies there. It gets very easy to get into deep meditation. You know, I did a 6-month retreat once, not in my cave, in another hut. Actually, you were there. You were your monk then at that time. Yeah. Remember, I think after I came off my retreat, they told me there was like a competition who was going to move in. And I think it was Damasiya, I think he won. And sort of he was going to move into my cave to get some of the energy. And he told me he couldn't move in the first day. It was just too much for him. So he had to stay outside till the energy levels went down a bit. It's still, when you get this peace, this momentum of energy and peace, you can stillness. So my cave has built up energy. That's why it's really good. And sometimes, look, even if you go over to Bodhidharma Monastery, that hall has got good energy there. Because, you know, there's been a lot of meditations happening there. A lot of great monks and nuns have been over there, meditated. It's built up some steam. And that's why it's a great place to meditate. So I invite you, if you know, if you get a bit bored over here, just walk over to Bodhidharma Monastery, go in the hall there and meditate over there. People do that. And you can get there and, wow, this is really still and peaceful. Because actually, what's happened before, this place is still a little bit new. But you know, we're building up the energies. And later on, it'll be a very powerful place. Yeah.
Joy comes up, so you say, just stay with that, right? Buddha taught anapanasati, so whenever become a seat taxi driver saying, oh no, you have to wash the bread. So what would be the introduction if you just stay with silence and then joy comes up? Just stay with the joy and not...
Yeah, you're just asking if that... if you just follow my usual instructions, just make peace, be kind, be gentle, you know, should you start looking for the breath or just wait for it to happen? The number best way, the Rolls Royce option, is just to wait for the breath to come to you, which it does. And the reason it does that, as I try to explain, is your mind will usually go to the most prominent disturbance. If there's a cough, you go to the cough. A laugh, you go to the laugh. It's a pain, you go to a pain. But when all of those things disappear, there's no sort of sound, you've got your eyes closed, the body's reasonably comfortable. What's the most prominent disturbance? When I first came to Perth, an entrepreneur brought into Perth one of these sensory deprivation tanks, these plastic containers, and you put salt water in there, and you know, get into your swimming trunks, and you go in there and you shut the lid, and it's totally soundproof, black, and you've obviously got some sort of ventilation to give you some relaxation. But apparently, he said, the one noise they couldn't get rid of, because people were breathing. You can shut out the noise from outside, but not the noise which is generated by the person inside the tank. And I was actually very disappointed, because what happened, I was with another monk, Ajahn Jagra, at the time. And this guy, you know, he came and said, do you would like to try it out? You know, because you're meditating, you might find it interesting. So, you know, I was actually quite interested in getting into a sensory deprivation tank and trying to meditate in there. You know, you don't have to cross your legs, there's no sort of pressure on your legs or your bottom, and it's quiet. So that'd be really good, you get some great meditation in there. But, you know, seniority, so he had to get in there first of all. So he went in there, and that's when he told me, he said, that's where he had all this noise of his breathing. I never had a chance to go in. Because the next day after Ajahn Chakra went in there, there was a big advertisement in the newspaper. These relaxation tanks, as used by Buddhist monks. He conned us. Invited, just try it to see, so he could put it in the advertisement. So I wasn't allowed to go in. But anyway, that what happens is, usually it just comes to you. However, it doesn't really matter that much. It's not that much of a disturbance if you just invite the breath in. And I usually say, am I breathing in or am I breathing out? And then I know what the breath is. And then I just follow the breath from there. But just with the most gentlest of efforts.
But from the silence and that, let's say the joy comes up first.
Is the joy, just stay with the joy.
Just stay with the joy.
Yeah, just have fun. Have the pity, Sukha. The breath is there.
The mind can just stay with the pity, Sukha, and forget about Anapanasati.
That's right. If you can land the aircraft straight in your cottage, that'd be a wonderful thing to do. I saw one of the magazines once, I think John Travolta, he's got his own aircraft. And he's on this commuter in the United States. Well, actually, the runway, you can taxi to the house. And it's got one of these air bridges, you know, which goes straight from his aircraft, straight into his house. You know, these rich people. So, you know, sometimes you can, like, go straight from present moment awareness to joy. Yes. Great. Yeah. Great. Body. Yeah. Oh. Okay. Oh. Yeah. 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 I think it's more than likely that wasn't actually transporting, but that was past lives. That's usually what happens. Actually transporting, it can be done with the mind-made body, but then you can usually be aware of the passage from one place to another. So I think it's more than likely when you're very, very deep meditation like that. You know, you do recollect past lives. So if that happens again, then, you know, you're aware of like something sort of Chinese or something Indian. Just pause and just, even subverbally or just verbally, just ask the question, where is this? Because you find that your mind actually will give you the answers if you only ask the questions. When is this? And often, sometimes you just open up this whole business of where you've come from. And it also very explains, you know, sometimes some of your idiosyncrasies as well. You know, just why, you know, you sort of maybe like Indian food, or people like sort of, you know, wearing Indian clothes or whatever. It's fascinating actually to get some of those insights into your previous lives. There's this one story that, this is our president, Dennis Shepherd. He's a very, very fascinating fellow, and he's got all these little hobbies, and one of the hobbies he was doing was hypnosis. And so regressing people into their past lives. And he said he went to one of the conferences of people who do this, and over in Sydney, and there's one guy in Sydney, he told this amazing story. He had this young girl, she was about 17, and they're quite pretty, but anorexic. You know, she just would not eat. And she'd been to the psychiatrist and the doctors, and they weren't helping her at all. You know, she's really getting so sick, it was, you know, she could die. And as a last resort, her mother took her to this hypnotist who could regress her to her past lives. So there the hypnotist, in the presence of her mother, sort of hypnotized her. She was very easy to hypnotize, and took her into a previous life. And all this information came out, that in her previous life, she was the younger of two sisters. And her sister fell in love with the same man. Her sister was more pretty than she was. She was quite plain. So boys being boys, the boy chose her elder sister, got engaged and married her. And the younger sister was so heartbroken that she committed suicide. She said, that was me in my past life. And in this life, because she lost out on the love of her life, because she was not pretty enough, that she went to excesses, to the point of anorexia, you know, trying to be beautiful. But the fascinating part of that story, that while she was saying this under hypnosis, the mother was crying hysterically. The mother wasn't hypnotized, she was just listening. And the hypnotist was worried about the mother. Why are you crying so much? And the mother actually let the hypnotist know, I was that sister. That was my daughter in this life. It was my sister in the previous life. I never told her this was a secret in our family. When I was young, I had a younger sister. We fell in love with the same man. That's her father. She could not marry him, but she came back as close as she possibly could as his daughter. And of course, once you see the why these things happen, then it's very easy to have a solution. And all these times of you get back to previous lives, if there is a problem, the problem gets solved. Phobias disappear. So I don't know if that was you, but what do you reckon? Is that a possibility? Think it might have been? Does it sound okay? Or do you think it really was like a traveling to another place right now? Next time, see what happens. Ask the question. So this is what happens when you get deep meditation. You get some wonderful experiences. Yeah, yeah, that's right, exactly. That's why it would have been like past lives. In that state, you can't hear. Your sound faculty would have been turned off. That's why, to me, it sounds more likely that you're picking up past lives. It just resonates. But next time that happens, explore. Find out more details. It's fascinating. Because as Buddhists, we talk about past lives. And sometimes people, especially in the West, they say, look, there's no evidence, you can't prove it. And it's true, you can't prove it to other people, you can prove it to yourself. And you get back in there and just find out who you were, what you did. Yeah. Yeah.
And then
Yeah, good. Yeah. 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 Okay. Yeah, but it is like this is part of the world of nimittas. And if those nimittas develop when you're not really still and peaceful, it can be anything. It can be just concocted. So you don't really believe in them at all. But there's nimittas which come up when you're very still and very peaceful. Now they are the ones you can trust. So these are more like, almost like echoes, and just the mind is concocting much of that. But the ones which happen in deep meditation, you can believe in them. Because you know they're much more powerful, they're clearer as well. So, the other stuff, you know, when it's coming, like your description of a keyhole, that I would ignore. But when it comes up in deep meditation, that to investigate. That's a really interesting stuff. The magic of the mind, the power of the mind, just some amazing things. So hopefully that helps. But do you want to go back there again? Yeah, we'd love to go back to those great meditations because they're really interesting. But to get back to those nice meditations, you remember what caused them. You let go, you're very peaceful, you're very still. When you want them, they will not come. When you relax and let go, then they come as much as you want. Because that's so common to many meditators. After my really first deep meditation, I just wanted it back so much. It was just so joyful and blissful. I just couldn't do it. Until you realize it's because I was trying. I wasn't being peaceful. I was interfering. I was trying to make it happen rather than letting it happen. So you had your hand up? Yeah. You can do lying down meditation, but when you're doing lying down, I encourage you, because you know, as I think I mentioned last night, I had food poisoning. Many of the monks had a couple of weeks ago, so I was like lying down meditating because it's just too painful to sit. And try and lie down in a position you don't normally go to sleep in. So, you know, I usually just go to sleep on my right side. So if I want to meditate, I usually lie on my back, because I just don't go to sleep in that position. And what it means is that the body psychologically knows I'm in a position, this is not sleep position, therefore it doesn't fall asleep. So if you are going to lie down in a position you don't normally fall asleep in. So the brain knows, she doesn't want me to sleep, she wants me to meditate. Very good. Okay, you had an extra 25 minutes today, but we're not going to charge you overtime. So please enjoy the morning, lots of nice things happening. So in the present moment, have fun, look for joy. If you feel a bit, yucky, go for a walk, have a rest, whatever. Don't worry about, if I go to sleep now, I won't wake up for lunch. You will wake up for lunch.